Avoiding your unfinished home projects because you're not sure where to start? Thumbtack knows homes, so you don't have to. Don't know the difference between matte paint finish and satin? Or what that clunking sound from your dryer is? With Thumbtack, you don't have to be a home pro. You just have to hire one. You can hire top-rated pros, see price estimates, and read reviews, all on the app. Download today.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
If you're ready for a new job, let Express Employment Professionals help you. Express is already hiring for summer jobs in a variety of industries. Job seekers never pay a fee at Express. Go to expresspros.com to find your location. That's expresspros.com.
Going up.
Prices keep going up these days. It feels like being on an elevator that only goes up.
Going up.
But not at Metro. We're pushing the down button.
Going down.
We've lowered prices. Get one line of 5G data for $40, period. That's 20% lower. And you get a free 5G phone when you bring your number. Only at Metro.
5-year guarantee on eligible plans. Exclusions apply. See website for details. Not available at Metro with T-Mobile in the past 6 months. Tax applies.
Okay, 3, 2, 1, hit it.
Chris Rongi, Amy Marks Kors, The Chris and Amy Show.
You know who it is.
Also, if you didn't know, this is called The Show.
Yeah. On 104.1 FM, KMOX.
Good morning, friends. It is a Thursday. It is May. Can you believe it?
Oh my gosh, it is May.
It's
Happy
May 1st. Yeah, it's May 1st, dog. We are well on our way to summer, aren't we?
We are. May is a great month. May is a month of hope and happiness.
It is?
I think so.
Yeah.
Because March is kind of gross, to be honest.
March is the best.
No, it's
not. Oh, my birthday's in it. St. Patrick's Day's in it. Pie Day is in it.
People think March should be spring.
STL Day is in it.
People think March is spring, but all of a sudden it's just like, it's February, duh.
March is the best. Amy Marks Kors, Chris Rongi, welcome into the show from 9 to noon. Usually, that's when we are on, but today we're off a little early because Cardinals baseball happens again today. 314-436-7900. Drop us a voice message, won't you? You could do that from the Audacy app, AUDACY. We're also streaming live if you want to look at us, and we are very handsome.
We are.
On Facebook, YouTube and Twitter, our account, and I swear to God, you better follow us or I am going to lose it at Chris Amy KMOX.
Time now for the top of the order. The top three stories everyone will be talking about.
Well, so much for breaking Connor Hellebuyck's spirit. The Blues lose game 5 in Winnipeg. They are down 3-2 in what is absolutely a must win tomorrow night at Enterprise Center.
You are correct. And Missouri lawmakers approve a plan to allow homeschool students in the state of Missouri to play sports. We'll see if this moves forward to the governor's desk.
And the U.S. and Ukraine has struck a minerals deal. So what does that mean for the war? We're going to talk to Major Garrett today. He will join the show at 10:25.
But we're on to the next one. Hey, it's a playoff series. I thought that was their best game. I thought it was our worst game. We're on to the next one. I mean, we can analyze every part of it. They were better.
On to the next one. Great Jay-Z song. Yeah, it really is.
It was the Blues' worst game.
Yeah, it was the Blues' worst game. And I thought, you know, the first couple of games of the series, they were outplayed. But that one last night, that was the worst of the games they were outplayed in. And it looked very, very different from games 3 and 4. So, you know, I was hoping, Amy, like you were, they'd go in and just stick it to Connor. But they didn't. So maybe coming back to Enterprise Center tomorrow will make him nervous again. But the Blues have to win. They absolutely have to win.
Yep. Yeah, it's a must win. See, this is why I said the other games were not a must win.
Let me take this back. It's not a must win. It is a you have to win or you will die.
Yeah.
Which is worse than a must win.
It is. You could argue. You could argue if that's the outcome. So here's the thing. There were a couple moments in last night's game that, okay, is this the trajectory-defining moment of the game, or are the Blues going to come back? What's interesting is when the Jets came out of the gate and scored first, I wasn't worried. It was weird. I was actually about to tweet, I'm not worried, but then the Blues scored right away to tie it up.
Yeah,
well, now it's too late. Now I missed my chance, and I wasn't worried. And I felt like, okay, this is a team that can bounce back, and I thought that was great that they bounced back. I started to get worried. There were two moments, and both involved Oscar Sundquist. One was the paddle save on Oscar Sundquist. It was a wide-open net, and Connor Hellebuck, who is a very technical goalie, probably because he studies more than any goalie in the history of the world, but he's a very technical goalie. He doesn't play with swagger. He plays by the book, and he made a swagger save.
Brilliant.
He made a paddle save.
Brilliant.
It was one of those that he was not making in the previous games, and I thought, oh, okay, that's a game changer. And then the embellishment call on Oscar Sundquist.
Yeah, what was he doing, man?
So I actually don't think it was an
embellishment. He took a little bit of an elbow to the face, kind of. But it wasn't
he grabbed his face.
Yeah.
And the thing is, hockey players grab their face, but he really did get tripped up in the skates. It wasn't like he dove. He did get caught up. He did get hit in the face. I thought that was a weak call. I thought in the playoffs it was an especially weak call. I also thought that the game was called unevenly. Not in the sense that it was for or against the Blues. It just wasn't consistent. I couldn't tell what call was going to be made or not.
Look, embellishment is a penalty. You have to know that as a player. And yeah, maybe he did get caught up, but what they called the embellishment on was like the elbow or the arm or whatever to the face. And he snapped back like he was LeBron, which just don't do that. Because yeah, maybe it's a weak call in the playoffs, and I don't disagree with you there, but don't give them an opportunity. Don't let them call something like that on you because it is completely unnecessary.
Yes, but again, why I'm a little more inclined to give Oscar Sundquist the benefit of the doubt here, there are embellishment calls where you take a slash and you pretend like your arm was cut off or you're tripped and you make it seem dramatic. I will say the elbow pads are tough, right? They're hard. If you take an elbow to the face, your initial reaction is to grab your face because, like, whenever you get hit in the nose, in the mouth, you're going to grab your face in a way that looks more dramatic, probably than maybe it calls for. Yeah, it could go either way. And like I said, some people were complaining about the refs, and I don't think they were calling for or against either team. It just felt, I was a little surprised what they didn't call. There were some calls, Bolduc got hit where the sun don't shine. He got speared, and it really was a spear. When you saw the replay, you're like, holy cow. And you can see how you would miss that. But there were also cross checks that the refs missed on both sides. On both sides. It was not favoring one team. But I think at the end of the day, the Blues did not look good. Their offense looked pretty bad. They looked just sclerotic in the neutral zone. They couldn't get anything going. That's what Winnipeg does, is they shut you down. They don't let you get speed in the neutral zone. And then they had bad turnovers, and they were putting the defense in a bad position. Jordan Binnington, outstanding.
They had one power play without a shot.
Yeah.
That you can't do that.
Jordan Binnington, you know, stood on his head. Yeah. He was outstanding. The offense did not look good. And they will have to be better in this next game. They're not going to win if they look like they looked last night.
Oh, absolutely not. And that's sort of what they did last night, was what I was afraid of going into the series. I kind of thought Winnipeg might look like that every night against them. And, you know, Blues rebounded at home. So I guess we have to hope that the home crowd is enough to get it done, right?
Well, the home team's won every game so far.
That's true. Look, it is... it's on you, Blues fans. If they don't win tomorrow night, your fault.
Well, obviously.
Your fault.
So, bring it. You need to bring it. But I will say this. I'm looking ahead. You shouldn't look ahead. It's stupid. However, even though the home team has won every game in this series, Jordan Binnington in game sevens, nails.
This is what I'd say.
Love that guy.
How much would you bet right now?
Not a million dollars.
How much would you bet that the only road team to win this series will be game seven? If you had to put money on it right now.
The only road team to win this series?
To win in this series would be game seven.
Yeah, well, we'll
How much would you bet right now? I'm asking you now.
$4.
$4.
But I feel very strongly about it.
That there is going to be one road win, and it will be game seven in Winnipeg.
Yes.
All right, $4.
Who do I pay?
Me.
You?
Yeah.
Do you pay me?
Yes. If it happens, I pay you. If it doesn't happen, you pay me. So either way, I win.
Yeah, I was like, wait, what?
Yeah, either way, I win. So either I get the Blues winning game seven to advance, I win $4.
Sports betting is never going to make it in Missouri if it's this confusing.
I'm not confused at all. I'm taking advantage of you. I absolutely understand what's going on.
Okay.
So, game six, and you know how I love a game six.
This guy loves game sixes more than he likes game sevens.
Yeah, everybody thinks I'm stupid for this, and that's fine. You can disagree with me. But here's my reasoning for loving game six, for anybody who's not heard it before. I love the uncertainty of not knowing if that's the last game or not. I love that. So I love going into game six knowing, okay, this might be the Blues' last game of the season, or there might be at least one more. We don't know yet.
But you know, game seven also has that because you could go to the
prepared.
Next round.
You're prepared. You know for a fact that somebody's out after that night.
Okay,
this is either the series goes on or it's over tonight. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
There's something about a game six I just love. And it always seems like a lot of the really cool stuff happens in games six.
Would you feel that way if David Freeze never existed?
Yeah, totally.
What game six do you go to other than David Freeze?
Michael Jordan in Utah.
Was that his flu game?
No, that was not the flu game. That was not the pizza, the food poisoning. That was he hit the shot, the final shot with the Bulls to win a title.
Game six in Utah. Okay, yep. So here's the thing. You know our text number because you know we love to hear from you.
Yep.
314-436-7900. Call or text. You can also leave us a voice message on the Odyssey app. It can be about the Blues. It can be about game sixes.
Yep.
It can be about any of that. It can also be about what we're going to talk about next, which is Missouri lawmakers approving a plan to allow homeschoolers play in school sports in their respective public schools. It hasn't passed yet. But the lawmakers approved it. It might reach Governor Kehoe's desk. That's kind of interesting, too. If you have kids in that that age group, if you have kids who have been homeschooled, know homeschool students, and whether or not they should play on the public school team. So we're going to be asking your opinions on that as well. But yeah, do you like game six more than game seven?
No one's going to agree with me on this. I am on an island all by myself, and I am perfectly comfortable with this.
What if you showed up on that island? It was a real island, and the only other guy on that island was David Freeze.
Well, I would say, sorry you're not in the Cardinals Hall of Fame, but that wasn't on me.
No.
I just want you to know that. Amy Marks Kors, Chris Ranji, feel free to text us 314-436-7900 or call in. You could do that. And voice messages, record one and send it straight from the Odyssey app.
What's today?
It's Thursday.
Really? Feels like Tuesday.
Well, we asked for your feedback regarding Ranji's controversial take that a game six is better than a game seven. And Bill, who is watching on the YouTube, said, Chris and Amy, one word about game sixes. David Freeze.
That's two words. It's not one word. We appreciate it, Bill.
Yeah.
I got two words for you. Steve Nash and Chris Paul. Must-see TV.
That's more than two words.
You didn't say two words. You said quick to the point.
You just said I got two words. Steve Nash and Chris Paul. Must-see TV.
That's why I messed up, because I was trying to think of two words. I could have said that. Okay.
Two words.
Nash and Paul.
That's three words.
Three words. Wait, I said Nash.
I got one.
Bill. Bill is Charles Barkley. That's so good. I got two words for you. Nash and Paul. Steve Nash and Chris Paul.
Must see TV.
That's like eight words.
Multiple sentences.
Oh, that's the best. NBA, thank you, Bill, for listening.
Thank you, Bill.
And for watching us on YouTube.
The NBA on TNT.
This is the best.
So good.
Thankfully, it's moving over to ESPN when they go there. Because
I thought Charles Barkley was not going. I thought that was the whole thing.
No, the whole plan is for the whole show to go.
What was the whole? I'm not doing anything but TNT.
I don't know. That's just
Bill gave us a thumbs up because he's a good sport.
Yeah, Bill is a great sport.
Thank you, Bill.
Just count your words first, Bill.
No, don't count them because I think that was hilarious.
It was delightful.
It was delightful. Okay, we also want to hear from you, 314-436-7900. This one hits close to home for me, and I know it is relevant to a lot of families out there. So there is a piece of legislation moving through Jefferson City that would allow homeschool students to play sports for their respective public schools. Now, growing up, and I homeschooled back in the pioneer days of homeschooling when people had never heard of it. I mean, now everyone's heard of homeschooling, but people had never heard of it. Most of the time when I said I homeschooled, people would say, "Where's that?" or "What's that?" So we in Missouri were not allowed to play sports for our local public schools. In Florida, they are. It's usually called the Tim Tebow law because he was homeschooled. I guess football is king, so they allowed him to play football for his public school. So
if I'm not mistaken, there are over 30 states that allow it, right?
You know, that I don't know. I don't know how many states. I just know Missouri doesn't allow it. And it's gotten more popular. The last census showed that 11% of households have at least one homeschooled student in that household, 11% of households with school-aged children. So this plan is sponsored by Missouri Senator Ben Brown. It was approved in the House Wednesday, 91-53. The vote, it's going to head back to the Senate for a final vote. And there was a similar bill last year that fell short of passage, but this is on its way to Mike Kehoe's desk. And I think this makes sense to me. Homeschooling costs taxpayers $0. The taxpayer doesn't pay anything for a parent who decides to homeschool their children. Homeschool parents still pay the taxes to the public schools, right? Like whatever your school district is, you're paying those taxes. And they have formed, it's funny, when I homeschooled, we were known for being really smart and not good at sports. We were just kind of, you know, like not the athletic type. For me, not having high school sports didn't impact me because in high school, I played ice hockey and there were no high school girls ice hockey teams anyway. So I just played club hockey, which is what all the other high school girls were playing. But I had friends who homeschooled and then in their senior year or the last part of their senior year would go to Lafayette or Marquette so that they could play baseball and be seen by scouts or football or whatever it may be. And so I do think this offers a great option. And I don't know what the downside is. I saw some of the pushback in the article from Jeff Knight, who said he's worried about the quality of education that some homeschoolers are receiving and said they need to take at least one class per day to make sure the kids are getting educated. Representative Kathy Steinhoff, who I really respect, is a former teacher. She said it's flawed because homeschool students wouldn't have to keep their grades high in order to participate in activities like traditional students. And I just had to say those arguments, they're irrelevant or they're ignorant of the facts, which is that homeschool students overwhelmingly perform higher than public school and traditionally school students on every metric, whether it's standardized tests, high school, elementary standardized tests, ACT, SAT, and even Harvard. A Harvard study just came out and showed that homeschool students perform better emotionally, psychologically, and socially. Homeschool students are doing okay when it comes to education.
Yeah, this is, if we can have a completely different conversation about academics and homeschooling, what I know is that it's just not possible for everybody to do it or even most people to do it. And most people aren't even considering homeschooling their kids. So that's a completely different discussion. When it comes to the sports, though, the side I would take on this is what about the kids who do go to the school and maybe a roster spot? They don't make a team because a homeschool kid made a team.
Be better? I mean, it's just No.
This is amateur sports. That kid goes to the school. They go to class at that school. They have lunch at that school. They participate in school activities. They should have the opportunity to play over somebody who does not go to that school. And the way I would see it, and I know you were homeschooled, but forget that you were, this isn't a personal thing. I just see it like if the school's not good enough for your kid to go to it, then it shouldn't be good enough for him to get to play a sport there.
So you're the first person that's made that argument, and I would listen to that argument. I would. I think there's more validity because we have another message, and thank you, from Millie on the YouTube. It said the downside is you'd have two different academic standards. And I'd say, yeah, it's a lot higher for homeschoolers. Homeschoolers score on average 15 to 25 percentage points higher.
Sure.
I mean, we have less than half of the kids in this country that go to public school can read at grade level. It's 13% in the city of St. Louis. Homeschool students have a much higher overall academic
standard.
But
also, as a homeschooler, you have more flexibility in your schedule throughout the day, right?
So I just think your argument that you made.
Yeah.
That's the first person I've seen make that argument, and that's an argument I'd listen to.
That's Amy Markscores. I'm Chris Ronji. We know prescription drug costs way too high, and this is something that affects almost everybody in the United States. And there are a number of pharmacists that are at Capitol Hill this week gathering there in order to try and lobby and bring attention to the fact that it is so expensive. We're going to talk to Doug Hoey, who is the CEO of the National Community Pharmacists Association, about drug costs and this effort to try and bring them down. That is next on KMOX. Amy Markscores, Chris Ronji on KMOX 104.1 FM. And it is time to go to the guest line this morning. As we mentioned going into break, we all know that drug costs are through the roof. And for a lot of people who cannot afford them, something needs to be done in that area. And there are hundreds of pharmacists from around the country on Capitol Hill to meet with members of Congress to lobby to do something about it. To discuss it with us is the CEO of the National Community Pharmacists Association, Doug Hoey, with us on KMOX. Doug, we appreciate your time today. Thank you for visiting with us.
Yeah, thanks for the chance to talk with you about the independent pharmacies and the high cost of drugs and how we can keep them lower.
Yeah, so how can we keep them lower, and what is your path to doing so?
So everyone knows drug costs are going up, and you know the United States pays the most in the world, but far and away. And one of the things, one of the features of the United States healthcare system that virtually no other country in the world has, and those other countries pay lower drug costs, are these middlemen called pharmacy benefit managers, or PBMs. And in St. Louis, there's actually the biggest, the largest PBM in the entire country is in your backyard in St. Louis. It's called Express Scripts.
Yep.
And these PBMs are owned by insurance companies. Express Scripts is owned by Cigna. And they have a motivation that the higher the cost of the drug goes up, the more money they make. And so what we're advocating here on Capitol Hill, here in Washington, D.C., and there's a number of pharmacists from Missouri who are here adding to the national voice, is to say, look, we don't need this role of these middlemen who are just adding costs to the cost of prescription drugs. We need to, they can have a role, but it should be an appropriate role. And we need to pay the pharmacies a flat fee, just a flat fee above what it costs them to buy the drug, and nothing more. And it's really simple. It's a simple, transparent, predictable model. And we've got some good traction. There's a lot of interest in Washington, D.C., especially with, there's a lot, with DOGE coming in for government efficiency and trying to cut out government waste and give the taxpayers a better deal. We're getting a lot of interest from legislators to look at this more transparent system that eliminates the big role of the middleman.
Doug, correct me if I'm wrong. My understanding about the PBMs is there are some like national pharmacies, like CVS, for example, that also operate as PBMs. And isn't there some effort to limit that to say either you get to be a pharmacy or you get to be a PBM. You can't be both. Isn't there something going on in that regard?
There is. There's actually big news for our industry. So just, you know, south of Missouri and Arkansas, Arkansas passed a state law just signed by the governor, signed by Governor Huckabee Sanders into law maybe 2 weeks ago, so very recently, that would say this conflict of interest, because we say it as a conflict of interest, and so did the state of Arkansas, that for these big insurance PBMs to also own pharmacies, and you gave a great example of CVS. CVS owns brick-and-mortar pharmacies, but then they also own these PBMs. They also own the insurance company Aetna. So when you have one person owning the insurance company, the prescription drug manager, and the pharmacy, it creates this conflict of interest. And what was happening, or what is happening, is that the big insurance companies, you know, Aetna or Caremark's the name of the PBM, would say, hey, we can make more money if we steer patients who are enrolled with Aetna or enrolled with Caremark into our CVS pharmacies. And in Arkansas, they said, look, we're paying more money as a state. We're not going to put up with that. It's hurting our pharmacies, too. It's causing pharmacies to close. Mm-hmm. In the last 5 or 6 years, the country has lost 10% of all the pharmacies in the country have closed, not just independents, but independents and chains. So Arkansas is kind of the tip of the spear. They're the, you know, one down, 49 to go, of saying this conflict of interest is not good for taxpayers. It's not good for citizens. You got to be one or the other. Pick your choice, but you can't serve two masters. You've got to be one or the other. The Express Scripts has a big mail order pharmacy, so they don't have brick and mortar stores like the CVS pharmacies, but they have an enormous mail order pharmacy that also presents that conflict of interest.
This is kind of a 101, almost a dumb question, but why do we need pharmacy benefits managers in the first place?
You know, it's really not a dumb question at all. And I know that's like a reflex thing to say when someone says it's a dumb question. It really is not, because the whole system is intentionally complex. It's very difficult to track where the dollars are going. So why do we need PBMs? Why did they start in the first place? Well, they started about 30 or 40 years ago, and they actually served a good purpose. Back then, patients would buy a prescription drug, and then they'd have to, it was called the shoebox effect. People would throw the receipt in a shoebox, and then at the end of the year, tax year, they'd take those receipts out of the shoebox and try to get repaid for them. And what the PBMs helped do, again, 40 years ago, was to make that an electronic process. And in fact, pharmacies were one of the first healthcare providers where the transaction was electronic. And so in the late 80s and early 90s, a patient could come into the pharmacy, and let's just say their copay was $10. The patient would pay the $10. And then the pharmacy, let's just say the drug cost the pharmacy $50, patient would pay $10, the pharmacy would get paid back $40, because remember the drug cost them $50, and then the pharmacy would get maybe a $7 or $8 dispensing fee, 40 years ago. So it was really simple, and it made it easy for the patient. They didn't have to have, file these receipts, go through all the paperwork. So it really was a good service. But what's happened over time is that these PBMs have merged and consolidated. And so now three of the PBMs, including Express Scripts, is one of them. Caremark, the CVS one, is the other. And then United Health, of course, has a PBM. Just those three PBMs control 80% of all the prescription traffic in the United States. And so they've gotten too big to fail. And so it used to be that the drug manufacturers, that they were the ones kind of raising the prices and causing things to become so expensive. But that's changed in the last 5 or 10 years. The PBMs have gotten so big and so powerful that they call the shots. They can say to the drug manufacturer, look, we're not going to pay for your drug, which means patients can't get your drug, unless you give us some rebates. You give us some payola. to include your drug on our formulary. Otherwise, the patient can't get it. So the PBM has morphed from this, hey, this nice, good bread and butter service to kind of this dragon with fangs that is controlling where patients can get their medication, how much they pay, and which drugs they get. The PBMs sometimes overrule physicians and often overrule pharmacists on which drugs patients can get. So it's kind of the, you know, the nice little puppy that, you know, grew up into be a pit bull.
And to that point, I think you described it with them throwing their weight around. But who said, okay, we'll let the PBM decide that I can't get this doctor-recommended procedure, or I should say medicine. I can't get this doctor-recommended medicine. Who said okay to that, allowing them to be the highest tribunal?
Yeah, sort of the judge, the jury, and the executioner is. Yeah, it's really our healthcare system has allowed that. So, I mean, technically, I'm sure if you had a PBM on, they'd say, oh, that's not true. A patient can get the medication that their physician prescribed. So technically, that probably is true. But what they don't say is that, but we're not going to cover it.
Right.
So the patient's left, you know, let's just say their benefit makes that $1,000 drug be a $100 drug. Of course, the patient's paying monthly premiums to help offset that. But if they don't use their insurance or if the drug's not covered, let's just say they have to pay the entire $1,000. So, yes, it's technically a choice, but it's not much of a choice because the patient has to pay the full brunt or the majority of the cost of the drug. And our healthcare system has allowed that. The structure of our the benefit design, how the healthcare benefit is designed. You've got the PBMs. Again, the higher the cost of a drug, the bigger rebate, the more money they're able to extract out of a manufacturer. So at one point, they were interested in keeping dollars low, the cost of drugs low, but now the higher the better. And that trickles down, of course, to higher healthcare premiums, health insurance premiums, higher costs at the counter. And also, it's the economic environment for the pharmacies, you'd think, oh, well, at least the pharmacies are making some money out of this. They're not at all. Pharmacies are closing left and right. Like I said, 6,000 pharmacies have closed, have contracted. There's 6,000 fewer pharmacies in the United States today than there were just 7 years ago.
So people are listening to this and they're wondering, okay, what's being done to lower costs for us? Is it going to happen? You said earlier that it seems like there's a bipartisan interest in getting something done here. So what's the real likelihood and how does it happen?
We think there's a high likelihood. I will say there's been actually some frustration on from our pharmacy lens because the PBM legislation that would reform some of their business practices to make it, again, we're interested in transparency for the patient, simplicity for the patient, and predictability for the patient and for the pharmacy and how much they pay and how much the pharmacy gets paid. That's what legislation that we support, our organization, we represent the pharmacy owners in the United States, 19,000 independent pharmacies across the country. That's what this legislation would do. And it's, you know, the Washington, D.C. environment is, you know, no surprise to anyone if they're reading or listening to the radio or reading news, highly polarized. However, PBM reform is highly bipartisan. It's passed committees, like, you know, committees 26-0, almost unanimously. What's holding it up, though, is, oh, I should also, this is important, it would save taxpayers, this PBM legislation would save taxpayers $5 billion. $5 billion savings. So it's good for patients. We think it would be good for pharmacies, too. What's holding it up is somewhat the toxic environment in Washington. You know, so because it saves money, it's a question of in what package does it get put into. Right now, there's a big budget bill that's being worked on in the House, and we're told it'll be included in that. We've been told it would be included in the bills that were needed to fund the government that were passed in December and then passed again in March. It's been frustrating from our standpoint because, hey, this saves $5 billion, and who couldn't use a $5 billion savings? We're told, though, by House Majority Leader, Speaker of the House, Johnson, and then Senate Majority Leader John Thune, that it's going to pass. It'll be in reconciliation. We're just very anxious. Our pharmacy owners and the patients we serve, you know, every day a pharmacy is going out of business because of the PBMs. And so every day they wait, it's one more pharmacy, one more small business that closes, and one more community that loses access to its local pharmacy. So we're antsy. We're ready for Congress to do its job.
And people are antsy to bring drug costs down, because that's the most important thing, is what people have to pay for the medicine they need. And for a lot of people, a lot of that stuff is unaffordable. So they are absolutely the most important part here. Doug Hoy, we appreciate your time today. Thank you for joining the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Doug is the CEO of the National Community Pharmacists Association, joining us on 104.1 FM KMOX. Hey, some breaking news, Amy.
Oh.
CBS News is reporting that the National Security Advisor, Mike Waltz, and Alex Wong, his deputy, are leaving their posts.
Oh,
I'm assuming this is after the Signalgate stuff. So the signal chats, and I guess that's the person who's falling on the sword, or the people.
Wow. Well, I guess maybe Pete Hegseth is closer to doing what Trump wants him to do, which is get it together.
That's Amy Marks Kors. I'm Chris Ranji. Did you see this next?
Now, did you see this with Chris and Amy?
Hey, Ranj, did you know it's National Password Day?
It is?
Yeah, that's it. I have nothing else to say on that point other than it's National Password Day.
Do I need to change mine?
I don't think so. I think this is one of those where there's no action needed from you.
Oh.
We're just celebrating.
Great. So I'm not getting the email that says change your password in 5 days, now in 4 days, in three, and then you get the countdown.
Countdown.
Then you're locked out.
Yeah. Nope. It's just everybody congratulate themselves on their password.
Why does everything have to have a password?
Too many
passwords.
There's a meme where a hacker says, hey, I have all your passwords. And the person who got hacked said, awesome, what are they? I need them.
That's awesome. Amy, have you heard about sperm racing?
Unfortunately, I have.
So last week in Los Angeles, the first ever sperm race was held.
Can you give us more details on how exactly?
So it was an event to raise awareness for declining male fertility.
Okay.
And so they had this whole event in front of a crowd, and they had a number of young men participating in it.
Oh, gross!
Well, they donated ahead of time.
Okay.
They don't do it in front of the crowd. They did it beforehand. So then the sperm are placed under a microscope.
Yep.
And it's magnified 100 times and then shown on the video screen, and they go through basically a course. It's a race course.
Yeah.
And the winner of the sperm got $10,000.
And baby.
It was a 20-year-old student from USC named Tristan Milker, which is it's either unfortunate or perfect name for the winner of the sperm race.
You know how they say baseball is a game of failure, right?
Yeah.
Like you're just not as much as sperm. Most of those guys don't make it.
Well,
there's like a bazillion of
them.
Yeah,
of course. Of course.
And sometimes none of them make it.
So in reality,
what's wrong?
All of us, everybody on Earth has won a race at least once.
That's right. That's
right?
A good way to put it.
And
May have lost our Alabama tickets contest, but you won the sperm race.
You didn't have a name yet, but you won a race.
Yeah.
How about that? So in order to prepare, Tristan Milker.
I feel like it's unfortunate.
He gave up alcohol.
Uh-huh.
He exercised regularly and slept 8 hours a day ahead of his matchup.
I wonder if he stopped riding bikes. I've heard that that's a... All I know is...
Really?
I had a friend who was a triathlete and he had a bunch of bikes. They're so weird. They're way weirder than runners. And they had trouble having kids, but then they did have like boom, 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 four kids. And he made his wife apologize to his bikes.
Wow. Actually, I kind of appreciate that.
He's like, go outside and say you're sorry.
It is the Chris and Amy show. We're going to be giving away tickets to see Alabama before the show is over at 10:40 today. We're done at 10:40 because the Cardinals pregame show is right after that. And you're going to get to listen in to Cardinals baseball again today. By the way, Kevin in Manchester or from Manchester on his way to Chicago listening to the show says, happy May 1st. That means it is only four more days until Cinco de Mayo. That's what it's called in St. Louis now because we're just a city of sinkholes.
What day is
May 5th?
What day is May 5th? It's a Monday.
Is it this Monday coming up?
Yes.
Yep.
We'll be at the Billikens Golf Classic.
That is correct.
Anyway, I was going to say, maybe wouldn't it be nice if we broadcasted next to a sinkhole?
Maybe we'll broadcast over one and we'll fall into it. Amy Marks Corps, Chris Ranji. When we come back, voice of the Cardinals, John Rooney, joins the show on 104.1 FM KMOX.
Now, the John Rooney Conversation on KMOX. Sponsored by Missouri Farm Bureau Insurance. We are Missouri Farm Bureau Insurance. And if you're a Missourian, we're for you.
The Cardinals would love to turn that leadoff hit by pitch into another run and make life a little easier for Helsley.
Just get one more. I mean, that's. I don't want to be greedy. I just want one more.
Well, how about three more with one big swing here?
All right, I'll be greedy.
The pitch. A swing, and there's a high fly ball. Right center field. Hit deep to the wall. We're greedy. It's a goner. A home run for Victor Scott. A three-run shot, and there's more breathing room for the Cardinals in the ninth inning.
Well, how about that? Cardinals sweep a doubleheader yesterday in Cincinnati, outscoring their opponent 15-1. So that was a good day for the Cardinals, who needed a couple of wins on the road, and they finally got them. We go to the guest line here just after 10 o'clock on 104.1 FM KMOX. John Rooney, the voice you just heard. And that is as excited as I've heard him in a long time, John.
Mm-hmm. So I'm a guest now.
Well, yeah. Well, okay. You're a regular contributor. You are a part of the show. You're a friend of the show.
So it should be the regular contributors line.
Well, everybody who's on this line is a guest.
I guessed so.
But you're a special guest. Not all guests are equal.
Yeah, you're a special guest, John.
Yeah.
Yes, in fact, we ride the special bus on these trips. Yes, we have a third bus, and one night the bus had special on it, so we all took a picture. The broadcasters and media relations and... And we took a picture in front of the bus, the special bus. So, yes, we are special.
You're special to us.
Well, thank you.
Doesn't that help? So how about that that ninth inning?
Well, what a day, huh? What a day.
A great day, but let's start with that game one, that ninth inning.
Well, frustrating. Very frustrating for the first eight innings to have just one run and hit the ball as hard as they hit it, lining into double plays or just having one thing after another go the other way and Oliver getting kicked out of the game. He wanted to go a whole series here in Cincinnati without being kicked out, and just didn't happen. And I think he got kicked out to keep somebody on his bench from getting the heave-ho, is what happened when he jumped over the railing. Though that jump over the railing, I'd have to give that a 10-5, not a 10. That was pretty good. But if he hit his foot on the top of the railing, that would have been an ugly video, that's for sure.
Yeah, that's risky. Like, you got to own that jump, because otherwise, like you said, John, then it goes viral for all the wrong reasons.
I'm telling you what, he jumped over that thing like he had a spring on his chair. And it was pretty good. But then the team responded after that. Yeah. And with two outs, Victor Scott got a pitch he could handle. Now, Alexis Diaz has been sent to AAA. He's having some issues, and I'm not sure he's 100%. Because we've seen him when he's good, and he's tough to deal with when he's on his game.
You know, we're talking about the ejection. We had Ollie Marmol. We have him every Tuesday on the Gas House Gang at 12. And toward the end of, I think, 2 weeks ago, the show, one of the listeners asked him if he almost got thrown out. I forgot what game it was. And if he was trying to get thrown out or wanted to. And since that happened, he's been ejected twice. So I feel like I feel like the listeners really wanted him to get ejected, and it finally happened.
Well, it seemed to put a charge into the team, I'll tell you that.
Yeah.
It worked. It kept somebody, Descalzo or somebody on the bench, from getting kicked out of the game. And it was at a point in the game where, a very important time, but they weren't getting the calls.
Well, we also saw Mason Wynn make his debut as a number two hitter. That seemed to work out for him and be a little jolt for the Cardinals.
I like the balance in the lineup with Wynn hitting second and moving Contreras down to protect Nolan Arenado, having Wilson bat number five. And under normal circumstances, now Abbott, a left-hander, is pitching today, so Jose Barrero is going to get a start in center field. But with a right-hander pitching tomorrow, Clay Holmes for the Mets, you'll see Scott batting ninth. There's good speed at the bottom of the order and a little pop, as we witnessed yesterday. And then you get to the top of the order with Nootbaar and Wynn to set the table for the middle with Donovan, Arenado, Contreras, and then whoever's DHing after that. I like the balance in the lineup, and let's hope they take off and run with it.
You know, you mentioned Contreras, who, he's been coming around. What have you seen differently from him that he's getting the results now that he wasn't getting in the first couple of weeks of the season?
Well, he's not wildly swinging at pitches out of the zone. He's not expanding the zone the way he was. And I think he was anxious to get something started after being so dominant in spring training. I mean, he hit everything hard in spring training. And then when the season started, then what he was hitting, he was getting fly ball outs, some ground outs, double play balls, and not very much fell for him. But now that he's taking a few more walks, and he's hitting the ball hard from right center to left field, and he's getting his share of contact and good hard contact, I think that's going to pay dividends. Now we need to get Nolan Arenado back on track. Arenado has seen his average take a dip, and he won the game last Saturday with a home run to left field, beating the Milwaukee Brewers. But he's had a rough time in this series, an RBI double on Monday to drive in the only run in the game. They need to get him hot, too. But as we see, Wynn heating up a little bit, Walker's taking better at-bats. Mm-hmm. He hit the ball very hard yesterday, and he's back in there in the lineup against the lefty Abbott today.
You know, John, I really liked this phrase from a coach that said, we don't look at momentum. We don't talk about momentum so much, after these two wins like this, as we talk about trends. I think that's so smart. It's not about momentum. It's about trends with a team and positive trends that you're seeing with a Cardinals team.
Well, that's why I go back when I get ready for a game and I take a look at the last 7 to 10 games to see what a hitter's doing. And I put that down on the card. And that pretty much tells you what you need to know about who's hot, who's not, who you may need to pitch around or be more careful with than the next guy in the lineup, or set up pitching around a guy to get to the next guy in the lineup to help your causes. But I take a look at those recent games, like Lars Nootbaar. He's hitting .320 in his last 7 games, a homer, 4 RBIs. He has a double or two in that mix, and he's getting his share of walks. He's walked 7 times over the last 7 games, and he's doing his part to get on. And he has a record 11 walks for March and April. He extended that with a walk in the second game of the doubleheader last night. And he's doing his job in that regard. And the on-base percentage for Nootbaar over the last 7 games, .469. That tells you that he's starting to heat up again.
Meanwhile, in terms of pitching, at least from the starter's perspective, the Cardinals have been solid this year. Matthew Liberatore getting the start today. And for somebody who was sort of given, before the season started, he was given the leash. They said to him, you're going to go, and, we're going to let you have this spot, and you have an opportunity to succeed and to fail, which is important. And he's really succeeded, John. He's looked really good this year for them.
No, he has the demeanor on the mound right now, like you're taking food off my table. I mean, I belong out here, and I'm going to get you out. And even when he has a rough inning, it's not 4 or 5 runs. It might be 1 or 2. And he's able to limit the damage. But he feels like when he comes to the park, he is going to win. And when a young pitcher gets that kind of thing going behind him, he's fun to watch. And I think the teammates feed off of that, too. But let's not lose what happened in the second game of the doubleheader last night with Gordon Graceffo.
Yeah.
He went the last five innings, picked up his first major league win because they got to about 75 pitches with Mats through four innings, and he had struck out six. So they brought Grisevo in, and I look up on the board, and I see 99 on a fastball. Haven't seen that from him in the past. When he came up last year in spring training, and then he did it again. He had like three, four pitches, 99 miles an hour, and then settled in between 96, 97, 95, in that range the rest of the way. But he had a really hard breaking ball going around 92, throwing a changeup in the 80s. And he went out there with a plan, taking advantage of an opportunity being the 27th man, and really impressed. John Mozeliak is sitting in the booth next to us for these games, and he even put up 99. Wow, we hadn't seen that from him. And last night, he took advantage of the opportunity, and he looks like a guy who might be a great setup man down the road. But right now, the Cardinals need a little depth in starting pitching, and he's starting at AAA. They have McGreevy and Grisevo as a couple of starters they could rely on if they need to dip down there and pick up one or two.
And in terms of the bullpen, there have been some issues this year, at least other than Ryan Helsley, and he's had a lot of, hasn't had a lot of opportunities to get out there and try to save a game because they haven't been in save situations. But as you look at the bullpen over about the last week or so, how well do you think they have done?
I think they've done a lot better job, and I think we're seeing King getting more command, feeling more comfortable, and I tell you, what we've seen out of a couple of the relievers out there has been very good. And of course, Ryan Fernandez was sent down, but Kyle Leahy and King, I think, could throw about every day. And they've been reliable in recent outings, and Leahy's been very reliable ever since spring training. And even before spring training, I think Leahy, what he did last year, impressed enough people that they put him in that role. Phil Maton's done a pretty good job. He's had a couple of hiccups, and every reliever is going to. Helsley has. And Helsley might get into a game today, even with a four-run lead. He might not. But I think just needing the work, I think it's been like 5 days. But they didn't need him yesterday for the doubleheader. And in many ways, I think that's a good thing with the Mets coming up. But by and large, the bullpen's getting better.
So we are 30 minutes away from the pregame show with Tom Ackerman today. The Cardinals will finish their series against the Reds before they come home tomorrow for a game tomorrow. 11:40 first pitch. John Rooney and Ricky Horton on the call today. John, we will talk to you soon.
So glad to be one of your guests today.
Well,
one of our best.
Yeah, your best
guest.
Our
favorite, our most special guest.
It's the best guest appearance I've done all day.
See, well, guess what? You get to do it again tomorrow during the Gas House Gang at 12:30.
Oh, I can't wait.
Yeah, I know. We can't wait to have
we'll
you.
We'll be listening.
And I will be on assignment tomorrow night. Mike Claiborne will be in for me tomorrow.
Okay.
And we'll see how things work out during the day.
You know, that's what Ed Farmer said about me one time when we were doing the pregame show. He said, Chris Ranji is on assignment, but I wasn't. I was late to work.
Well, you were assigned to get there, and you didn't make it.
It's a whole story. I'll tell you about it some other time.
That's the on assignment has been a joke for years.
It's and, the best.
But it explains, you know, in other words, if you're here on assignment, he ain't going to be there.
Oh, no.
That's it. Whatever the assignment is, he's not showing up today.
That's right. It. Looking forward to the game today, John. Thank you.
Me too. Let's keep the rain away.
Yep.
10:45 for the pregame show and an 11:40 first pitch from Cincinnati, the Cardinals and the Reds. Coming up on 104.1 FM KMOX, we're going to talk to Major Garrett at 10:25. So make sure you stay here for that.
With CBS's Chief Washington Correspondent.
Major is also the host of America Decides on CBS News 24/7. We have the Chief Washington Correspondent with us now. How's it going, Major Garrett?
Have you seen the news?
Are we talking about which news?
Mike Waltz?
Yeah, Mike Waltz.
Yeah.
All right, so here's a quiz. Name all five national security advisors who've worked for President Trump. Go.
Mike Waltz.
Go. Come on. Go.
And,
come on now. Come on. Quickly. Five.
Now I'm freaking out.
Fred Buttimer.
I'm freaking out, Major.
We're not good on the spot.
Yeah,
Michael Flynn, H.R. McMaster, John Bolton, Robert O'Brien, and now Mike Waltz.
Yeah, that's a lot,
five
right?
National security advisors in 4 years, 102 days.
So is that, it's not unusual for people to leave an administration. Like, I know the press secretary, they're always going through a couple of those at least. This is unusual though, right?
Hyper unusual. For those in the audience who may not know what the National Security Advisor does, the National Security Council was created as the White House organizing hub for the State Department, the Pentagon, and all the various intelligence agencies. And that person is closest to the president in the West Wing all the time to not only brief the president, but to coalesce the policy for the administration, whoever the president is, and be the touch point when the president is otherwise doing things for the State Department, the intelligence agencies, the Pentagon, and all the key component parts of the national security apparatus. It was created as a Cold War entity to make sure the president had constant eyes on the entire national security apparatus when the president was necessarily doing other things. And to have five in 4 years and 102 days is not only record-breaking, but it goes to a kind of impatience or lack of confidence that the president has in this super important non-Senate confirmable post. Defense Secretary, Secretary of State, CIA Director, all that stuff goes through the Senate confirmation process. The National Security Advisor doesn't. The National Security Advisor is chosen by the president, and once you're chosen, you're in. So it's really tight to the president and the executive branch. And Mike Waltz is no dummy. He has tremendous experience, battlefield experience, read a couple of books about it, very much on the Trump MAGA world sort of axis of interpretation of the world and world events and Trump policy. He left Congress to do this, and 102 days in, no matter how MAGA he was, he's now unemployed, a MAGA flame out, and out of Congress. That's a pretty sorry state of affairs for him.
So who steps in his place?
Who knows? I mean, seriously. They also, according to our reporting, are letting go or dismissing or firing, however you want to, whatever apprentice television show language you want to put it in, getting rid of the deputy national security advisor. So there's nobody right in the queue, right behind it. Hegseth is melting down at the Pentagon, firing three people he brought in last week and the week before. So the Pentagon doesn't have senior leadership underneath the defense secretary. There's now no national security advisor or deputy. So, you know, I know we all sort of have defaulted to this belief that only the president matters and only the president deals with things. And to a certain extent, in the Trump presidency, that's true. But this is a level of dysfunction that he has created. Again, this position is his choice and his choice alone. Doesn't have to ask any senator about it. Doesn't have to go through any confirmation process. It is linear to his tastes and desires. And five times he hasn't been able to get what he thinks he wants out of this particular position.
Major, to that point about how many people are fired and all of the turnover that we see, there was a lot of, with the voters, a lot of fondness or reminiscing about Trump 1.0. And I'm not sure if that's what voters were expecting in Trump 2.0, but Trump 2.0 is very different. He has a very different set of people around him. Mm-hmm. What are some of the key differences that you see that voters might not realize that Trump 1.0, that's not going to show up?
No, it's not. No, not at all. And that's why this firing of Mike Waltz is so interesting to me. So Trump, the first time around, it was a surprise victory to him. I recount that in my book, Mr. Trump's Wild Ride, what election night was like and how surprised they were, how downcast they were when the polls closed. They were not expecting to win. They thought it was possible, but not probable. And once he did win and became president-elect, they did not have not only a fully formed transition plan, they didn't have a nominally
informed transition plan. They started basically from scratch. And when you start from scratch, you're always trying to play catch up. And they didn't know with whom they could create alliances. They didn't know what their own Trumpian approach was going to be. It was kind of evolving. And they didn't know who was really on their side. Lots of people who were close to the Trump campaign from 2016 began calling Republicans who suddenly got on board as post-election Trumpists. They only were Trumpists after he won. So they didn't know who they could trust. And that was always something filtering through how people were hired and then fired the first time around. This time, for 4 years, they have built a cadre of quote-unquote revolutionaries, people who were Trumpists the first time around and became even more hardened Trump loyalists in the 4 years out of power. And through various think tanks that were put up by people funding the Trump organizations, political and otherwise, they got themselves in a very locked arms perspective on a next Trump administration, should there be one. And they're the ones populating this administration now. They're the ones who've written all these executive orders and had them ready to go from day one, coming out in sort of a blitzkrieg fashion. That's different. So Trump has lots of loyalists. Mike Waltz thought he was among that group, thought he had proven himself in the House of Representatives, on the campaign trail, during the transition. He thought he was safe and had established, through all the things he advocated for President Trump when he was out of power in the House of Representatives, that he was in. Nope, he's out. And so that makes you wonder, within this group that thinks that they're all on board and all safe because they're all hardened Trump loyalists, what actually is your job security, and who can knife you in the back, and who can make you expendable suddenly? Look, everyone thought in the first 2 weeks after the Signal revelations through the Atlantic magazine that maybe Mike Waltz was going to be out. But then Trump kept involving him in cabinet meetings, kept calling on him, kept referring to him. So I don't know what the ins and outs of this particular dismissal today are about. Everyone had sort of thought he had Mike Waltz weathered the storm. And the second Signal revelation was all about Pete Hegseth and sharing military plans with his wife, his personal attorney, and his brother. Everyone thought, well, now the harsh scrutiny is on Hegseth, not Waltz. Well, I don't know if Hegseth is next or not, but now we know that initial hesitancy to fire people, which everyone told us, well, Trump's not going to do it this time around. He's not going to fall for the media narratives and outside pressure. Well, okay, that was false. He did. Waltz is out. Deputy National Security Advisor is out. Who's next? And we're going to play that Washington game now in a very similar way than we did in the first Trump administration, which I didn't expect would start this rapidly.
The U.S. and Ukraine deal, the minerals deal, is this a good step forward?
It's a step forward in the sense that what Ukraine needs in any conversation with Russia is a sense that the United States has a continued interest in its future as a sovereign country. Having a minerals deal with the United States recognizes A, Ukraine's sovereignty, meaning it's not going to be overtaken by Russia, and it has ongoing business interests there. Would the Ukrainians have preferred that this also include in writing security guarantees to back it up? Yes. Did they get them? No. The Trump administration says those are implied. If we have business relationships and we're extracting minerals and we're making money off it, you can be sure under a Trump administration, probably any future one, we're going to militarily protect those economic interests. That's implied. Ukraine right now would like more than implied guarantees on the security front, but it will take what it can get and a recognition of the United States of its ongoing current sovereignty and future sovereignty is a start.
Major Garrett, as always, we appreciate it. Thank you for hanging out with us for a few minutes today, and we'll talk to you Thursday of next week.
It's been a busy day already, folks.
Yeah, well, get back to work. It's about time.
Yeah, yes, indeed. Yes, indeed, sir. You've been
over there loafing all day.
It's all I do. I got three hammocks in my office. I just rotate the three hammocks.
That's because you're waiting on those couches.
You set an alarm, and the alarm wakes you up so that you can get into the next hammock.
Exactly. That's all I do.
There you go. Thank you, Major.
Bye-bye.
Major Garrett is the chief Washington correspondent for CBS News. His show is America Decides, which you can watch on CBS News 24/7. Hey, congratulations, Dennis in Jerseyville.
Yeah.
Going to go see Alabama on May 25th at the Thunder Ridge Nature Arena in Ridgedale, Missouri. Now, everybody but Dennis lost. That means tomorrow, one more chance to win. We'll give away one more pair of tickets for Alabama tomorrow between 9 and noon. You have to be listening for your chance to win, Amy.
Yep.
You can't win. Do.
No, I can't.
It's against the law, actually.
It is. Hey, can I do a quick update on Bill Belichick's girlfriend, Jordan something?
Yeah, how's she doing?
Jordan Hudson. Well, did you know that within 18 months of meeting Bill Belichick, she suddenly bought an $8 million real estate investment in Boston area and in Cape Cod?
Yes.
So, and you may think, well, maybe she was wealthy to begin with. Well, maybe her father was a fisherman and her mother manages a sex toy shop.
A sex toy shop?
Yes. She manages a sex toy shop.
Hold on. Do you think that's how they met and that's why they didn't want to talk about it?
Oh, my gosh.
Bill walked into the sex toy shop?
Oh, my gosh. It's in Provincetown.
Do you think that's what happened, maybe?
I do. So anyway, real quick, all of her classmates.
Can we speculate some more?
We can, but listen to this. So her classmates are saying this is totally her. She is very controlling, not a surprise. They tried to interview her mom about the situation, and the New York Post said the mom declined to speak. But one local construction worker who used to cut Belichick's lawn was more than willing to weigh in. It's weird as hell, said 40-year-old Matt Torville.
I bet Matt Torville's he's probably interested. That's what happened, I bet. I bet
Bill went. Do you think they met at the sex toy shop?
I bet Bill went to that store and her mom said, "You would love my daughter.
My daughter, she's 20.
I have somebody for you.
She's 20 years old."
What if that's what happened? Somebody needs to look into this.
Can you shop at a sex toy shop when you're 20? I thought you had to be 21.
No, you can be an adult.
I don't.
You have to be an adult. Yeah, Frank Ladd is like, oh, no, 18. He knows.
Really? If you should have to be 21.
Hey, we got Cardinals baseball coming up here. It is the finale of the series in Cincinnati. We'll be back with you tomorrow at 9 o'clock. Don't worry. And if you missed anything on the show today, the conversation with John Rooney, Major Garrett, Doug Hoy about pharmaceuticals, listen to the podcast on the Odyssey app. Bye.
Podcasting isn't just evolving. It's having a full-blown identity crisis. I'm Allison Marino, host of What's a Podcast? The Revolution Redefined, a new series that pulls back the curtain on the forces shaping the medium now and what that means for all of us who love podcasts. I'm really excited to share the official trailer where you'll hear from some of the biggest names in the space. Ira Glass, Leo Laporte, Guy Raz, Hernan Lopez, Lex Friedman, AJ Feliciano, Dan Granger, and yeah, me too. Here it is now.
I still want to kill the word podcast.
That's not just a hot take. It's a symptom of an identity crisis.
Big company run media, and people are trusting it less and less. It's really important that we're independent.
There's a handful of companies that control the vast majority of podcast inventory that have the vast majority of the gigantic shows.
We left radio behind for a reason. We wanted to get away from all the gatekeepers.
I don't know that you could do this as effectively in video.
Podcasting is at a crossroads. I've watched the industry swing from hype to consolidation to reinvention. But this time it's different. From the producers of the documentary Age of Audio, Oxford Road presents the Media Roundtable special series. What's a podcast? The Revolution Redefined.
All of us who work in the media, like, yeah, we got to run a business and like, we got to make a living and we got to sell our ads and we got to do all that. But we all got into it because like, I think most of us, like, it just gave us a feeling.
A three-part series where you'll hear the leading industry voices give their takes on what podcasting has become and where it's headed next. Teaming up with Oxford Road and Age of Audio director Sean Colon for this series was fun, but also kind of a wake-up call. If you love this medium as much as I do, you've got to listen to What's a Podcast? The Revolution Redefined. It's out now, wherever you get your podcasts.